From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the treatment of an Indian envoy in New York sparks condemnation from the Indian government over what it calls barbaric treatment. We hear from one of the first people to escape the ongoing violence in South Sudan.
Most areas that the shooting was going on was close to civilians. You wouldn't see, you wouldn't really know what was happening. What we were able to hear are gunshots.
A controversial budget deal struck by Republicans and Democrats passes a key hurdle in the Senate, and the a cappella male voice choir who only sing the songs of Leonard Cohen.
Our mission is to be stewards of that text and to be, you know, vessels for the intention of Mr. Cohen.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. A major diplomatic storm is brewing between India and the United States following the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York. The Indian government has ordered the removal of security barriers in front of the U.S. Embassy in Delhi in protest against the treatment of its diplomat. Nick Harper reports from New York.
India's Deputy Consul General in New York, Devyani Gopragadi, has been accused of exploiting a servant she brought over from India to work for her in New York. The servant claimed she was promised nearly $10 an hour, but Ms. Gopragadi instead paid her just $3.31, much less than permitted under her U.S. visa status. The Indian media is reporting the diplomat was handcuffed while dropping her daughter off at school and strip-searched by police. The Indian government say they're shocked and appalled at her treatment and say she's been humiliated by the U.S. government. In Delhi, protests have sprung up. Police have removed security barriers from in front of the U.S. embassy there in retaliation, and a visiting U.S. delegation has been snubbed. Ms. Gopragadi has denied the charges of visa fraud and making false statements.
The U.S. Senate has approved a new budget deal in a procedural vote. In a rare show of bipartisan cooperation, 12 Republicans joined Democrats in voting for the bill, all but ensuring it will pass in the final measures. The bill sets the budget for the next 2 years, with just over $2 trillion allotted for government spending in 2014 and 2015 combined. It also rolls back $63 billion in cuts related to domestic and military spending that were automatically in place due to the sequester, substituting other fiscal savings in their stead. The new budget is also designed to reduce the deficit by $23 billion. The government budget has caused much back and forth over the last few years, but this agreement will prevent another government shutdown in January 2014. And Russia has agreed to cut the price of the gas it supplies to the Ukraine by almost one-third. Following negotiations between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart Viktor Yanukovych in Sochi, Moscow also agreed to buy $15 billion worth of Ukrainian government bonds. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
Following negotiations in Sochi, Russia has agreed to slash the price of its gas supplied to Ukraine from more than $400 to $268 per 1,000 cubic meters of gas. The new agreement amends a 2009 deal signed by former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, for which she was imprisoned. Speaking after the talks, Russian President Vladimir Putin said, quote, "Russia and Ukraine are united both by many centuries of our friendship and by having lived a long time together in the same country."
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. President Obama met with the leaders of 15 different tech giants, including Apple, Google, and Facebook, on Tuesday to discuss National Security Agency spying practices and how they affect the online world. Many of the companies have expressed concerns about the NSA co-opting their data. The meeting came the day after a U.S. federal judge ruled that some of the NSA's phone call data mining programs are unconstitutional. Priscilla Huff has an update.
In a 68-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Richard J. Leon wrote that the systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single American, surely this NSA program infringes on that degree of privacy that the founders enshrined in the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees guarantees the right of citizens to not be subject to unreasonable search and seizure. And while the ruling finds the NSA activities unconstitutional, from a legal perspective, almost nothing will happen in the near future because the case now goes to an appeals court.
And a British doctor who traveled to Syria to help treat the war wounded has died after being detained in the country for a year. The family of 32-year-old Dr. Abbas Khan, an orthopedic surgeon, say the Syrian National Security Agency had promised his release this week, but later announced that he died. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
Dr. Abbas Khan, a father of two from South London, was arrested by government forces within 48 hours of arriving in Aleppo last year to work as an emergency surgeon. Earlier this year, his mother found him in a prison in Damascus, weighing just 32 kilograms and barely able to walk. She was told she could visit him on Monday. However, when she got to the National Security Agency's headquarters, she was informed her son had died. When his mother did see him, Dr. Khan claimed he had been tortured while being detained without charge and held for much of the time on his own.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Indian government officials have refused to meet American delegates in India following the alleged poor treatment of an Indian diplomat in New York. Reports said Devyani Kubragade was strip-searched after the 39-year-old was arrested last week. She was also charged with visa fraud and making false statements concerning her Indian housekeeper, accusations she denies. India's National Security Advisor described the envoy's treatment as barbaric. For more on the story and what impact it's having on US-India ties, I spoke to New Delhi journalist Rahul Bedi.
Today, the Indian government has taken some retaliatory steps. It's cancelled identity cards which have been issued to U.S. diplomats, which allow them easy entry to airports and other government facilities. It's withdrawn these. It's also removed the protective barricades around the U.S. embassy, which have been in place for many, many years. In fact, I think since 2001, since 9/11. And it's also considering cancelling or at least temporarily terminating import licenses, which includes things like liquor and foodstuff for the U.S. Embassy. So the Indian government is very incensed. The Indian establishment is very angry for what it calls objectionable behavior towards its diplomat in New York.
The Indian government has said that they feel that their diplomat was humiliated. I mean, can you just explain what's alleged to have happened?
Well, according to reports which have come in from the U.S. And diplomatic sources, the Deputy Consul General in New York had gone to drop her two children off to school. And suddenly she was accosted by the State Department Enforcement Agency and handcuffed in public in front of her children and marched off and handed over to U.S. Marshals. She was then taken to another facility where she was strip-searched and she was DNA swabbed and put in a cell with criminals and prostitutes. Subsequently, she was let off on a bail of $250,000, and she had to surrender her passport. She is charged with providing false information about her maid, who she imported from India. She's alleged to have claimed that she was paying her the standard rate of about $9-$9.5 an hour when she was paying her much less. And she had stated, made a false claim on her visa application that she would pay her a certain amount of money but was not doing so. So if she is convicted of both these charges, she faces up to 15 years imprisonment in a U.S. facility.
What's been the reaction of the media in India to this story? And what would the Indian government like to see happen in terms of a possible resolution here?
Well, I think right now the Indian government is very incensed. In fact, there's a very senior U.S. congressional delegation visiting Delhi. And yesterday, the Speaker of the Parliament, as well as the National Security Advisor, refused to meet them. Today, the Prime Minister in waiting from the opposition BJP party and Rahul Gandhi, who is supposedly the Prime Minister designate from the Congress ruling party, also refused to meet this delegation. So right now, I think nobody's looking at redressal. Everybody's looking at some kind of, I assume, an apology would be in order. But the U.S. State Department deputy spokesman has said that there was no high-handedness, there were no transgressions, and everything was according to standard operating procedure. So I think this is a standoff which could get a lot worse because there is a huge, huge amount of anger across official and public circles, and the television channels are really going crazy over this story.
New Delhi-based journalist Rahul Bedi. The controversial budget deal struck by Republicans and Democrats passed a key procedural hurdle in the Senate today, which essentially assures its passage later this week. Some Democrats are upset about the deal kicking 1.3 million people off of unemployment benefits, while some Republicans are protesting the cuts to military veterans' pensions. But enough lawmakers on both sides seem resigned to passing the budget and avoiding another government shutdown. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
When Wisconsin Republican and then vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan brought forward a budget in 2011 that deeply cut government spending, Democrats unanimously opposed it, calling it an austerity plan that would hurt the social safety net and the economy. But the budget that passed the House last week and is set to pass the Senate this week, with overwhelming Democratic support, sets the government budget even lower.
This is not a good budget, and it's not a good budget because the Republicans have refused to add 1 cent of new revenue by ending corporate loopholes or asking the wealthy to stop paying their fair share of taxes.
That's Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, who plans to vote for the bill. He said the bitter partisanship and manufactured crises of the past few years has allowed the conversation to shift further to the right, as progressives have focused solely on fending off attempts to cut Medicare and Social Security and preventing another government shutdown, two goals accomplished in this budget.
The conversation must be, and you know, so we're going to be talking about now, is how you create the millions of jobs this country desperately needs, how we invest in our crumbling infrastructure, how we make college affordable, how we protect a disappearing middle class.
33 Republicans voted Tuesday morning to block the budget bill. Some, including the Senate's top Republican, Mitch McConnell, said it's wrong to roll back some of the deep automatic sequester cuts, cuts he called hard-won progress. Others, including Mississippi's Roger Wicker, opposed the budget for cutting $6 billion over 10 years from the pensions of current and future military retirees, including those retired because of a combat injury or other disability.
The military retiree earns his pension, and we want to make sure that pension buys as much in 2016 as it bought in 2015. And that's the simple reason for the cost of living adjustment. What this legislation says to retired veterans, and as Senator Ayotte points out to retired disabled veterans, regrettably, is we're not going to keep you up with inflation until you get to the age of 62.
A number of veterans groups joined senators Tuesday to speak out against the cuts outlined in the budget, which they estimated would cost the average veteran more than $71,000 over a lifetime after 20 years of military service. Tom Tarantino with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America said he's frustrated, both with the final budget deal and the political process that created it.
You know, when this budget deal was announced, they spent a lot of time talking about all the things that weren't on the table, things that were sacred to both sides that they weren't going to discuss so they can come up with a compromise. I was shocked that apparently veterans and military families are on that table. That part of the discussion of how we're going to balance the budget is on the backs of the people who have sacrificed the most.
Some Republicans filed an amendment this week that would replace the cuts to military pensions with cuts to food stamp benefits and the earned income tax credit, which benefits middle and low-income families. But South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham said it's uncertain whether Senate leaders will allow a vote on that or any other amendment in the Senate's rush to leave Washington for the holidays.
And this budget's probably going to pass because everybody's hell-bent to get out of town and not shut down the government. No, we're in a big hurry around here to show you how functional we are. And we're insensitive as a Congress and, quite frankly, a country.
As the budget heads toward final passage later this week, many lawmakers and outside advocates say it's just as insensitive to cut off the unemployment benefits of 1.3 million Americans who have been jobless for more than 26 weeks. Because efforts to extend the funding in the budget bill were unsuccessful, those benefits will expire on December 28th. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Dozens of people have been killed during clashes triggered by what South Sudan's President Salva Kiir described as an attempted coup by the soldiers supporting the former vice president. About 16,000 people have taken refuge at two United Nations military bases near Juba, the nation's capital. The unrest continues despite a government statement claiming to have full control of the situation. The government also says 10 people have been arrested in connection with the violence. Earlier, FSN's Africa correspondent Justin Drelays spoke to Charles Regott, one of the first people to escape the fighting in southern Sudan's capital.
The airport is closed. People can't fly out. And there has been a curfew from 6 to 6. And the road has been literally closed. But Luckily, we managed to get out because we were on one side of the river that is away from the city center. So we managed to organize ourselves and get some mode of transport. And immediately the curfew was lifted, we decided to take off.
Could you narrate to us what you saw happening in Juba?
Actually, the fighting erupted on Sunday, and as we were trying to figure out what was happening, we couldn't know exactly, but the whole night there was gunshots, and gunshots. And in the middle of the night, then towards morning, we began seeing injured soldiers, you know, casualties just coming from the battlefront on the other side of the river. They were being brought by military personnel. Most of them were actually injured seriously. So then we realized things are not very good. So when we tuned on to the radio, we had the head of state saying there was an attempted coup.
How did you make it out of Juba?
We crossed over from the main city, I mean from the city center to the other side of the river. And then after crossing over from the other end, so then we were on this road that connects connects South Sudan to Uganda. That comes to all the way to Nimule and then to Elegu. So we organized our own private means of transport and began the journey. As soon as things were a bit cool.
That was at a lot of risk, I imagine, because I was told there was not a lot of movement. People were not moving. Must have taken a lot of risk.
Certainly, yes, it's taken quite a bit of courage. One, because everybody is scared because you don't know what's going to happen the next time. And anybody can come in, soldiers or even civilians that are armed, and attack you on the way. But then we calculated and thought, well, it's better to take the risk early than wait for, because we don't know, maybe other rebels are going to come in to reinforce the others or what. We really don't know what could happen. So we thought it's better to take the risk and, you know, try and see how far we can go, than wait until things are bad, because presently, as we speak, the airport is closed. The city center is still not fully operational. Actually, we are made to understand that there's still some gunshots going on within the city center. So then that would mean that probably there are some rebels that are still being sought after, or that the forces have still not cleared everything. So then we just thought, well, it's better to just try and start early.
In terms of casualties, you said you saw soldiers being carried. What is the status of civilian casualties and even the military ones you saw?
Presently, as we speak, civilians are moving from their residences into the UN quarters, and the UN has welcomed them. They are providing food, they're providing medicine to the injured. But outside the UN compound, most people are fending for themselves. We know that there are people who sustained injuries. I know I've heard from Kenyans that about four Kenyans were killed. I've heard about one Eritrean who was injured, killed. And then a number of others, nobody has really a proper count of how many people have been injured. But for the military, yes, I did see quite a number that had injuries and were bleeding. And, well, it was a sorry state. I mean, those are some of the things that made us just to decide to move.
Would it be right to say the shooting was random, so civilians could have also been targeted, or this was a crossfire?
Well, to be precise, the shooting, most of it took place at night. What we could see is the trajectory taken by the bullets and whatever weapons that were being used. We wouldn't know who was shooting who at night or even during the day, because most areas that the shooting was going on was close to civilians. You wouldn't really know what was happening. What we were able to hear are gunshots.
FSN's Justin Drelays reporting from the Uganda-South Sudan border. Russia's government has cut the price of gas supplies and given a loan to Ukraine after a meeting between Ukrainian President Yanukovych and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The meeting was an attempt by the embattled Yanukovych to gain financial support for Ukraine's struggling economy amid huge protests after his government suddenly backed away from a long-anticipated trade and reform agreement with the European Union last month. Tom Barton reports from Moscow.
Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has managed to come away from this meeting with Vladimir Putin with a natural gas discount from over $400 per 1,000 cubic metres down to $268, and a loan of $15 billion to help prop up Ukraine's struggling economy. The two presidents reportedly did not discuss Ukraine joining a Moscow-dominated customs union. However, for the huge crowds of protesters in Ukraine and observers in the European Union, this is Russia's government rewarding Yanukovych for spurning a trade and reform deal with the EU that was years in the making. The turn back to Ukraine's former Soviet masters is infuriating the opposition, who accuse Yanukovych of selling Ukraine to Moscow and demand Russia back off and leave them to integrate further with Europe. Russia's government has pressured Ukraine and stopped some exports from the country to try and force it away from the EU. What some see as a tug of war over Ukraine has seen mistakes all round, says Andrei Kortunov from Russia's Council on International Affairs.
No matter what decision is made, no matter what side is chosen, I think the negative side effects of any decision will be significant.
Yanukovych maintains that Ukraine needs trade with Russia and needs financial help to plug an estimated $17 billion hole in next year's budget. EU representatives have been saying the door to an association agreement is still open, but condemn what they see as Russian government bullying of a former part of the Soviet Union. Whoever was in charge, says Andrei Kortunov, they wouldn't find the choice before them appealing.
Ukraine simply cannot make a choice right now. It is really connected to Russia and depends on Russia in very many ways, not just in terms of the economic interdependence, but socially, you know, culturally. At the same time, definitely Ukraine cannot simply, you know, cancel its European integration strategy.
Protests have continued round the clock for 3 weeks now, with huge crowds and increasingly popular leaders such as ex-boxer Vitaly Klitschko and ex-minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk demanding Yanukovych's resignation. He and his party are seen as closely linked to the huge levels of corruption in Ukraine. Though some Ukrainians in the east of the country have linguistic ties to Russia, many in the centre and west of Ukraine see future integration with the EU as a route to greater prosperity and less corruption. But this agreement is being hailed as a victory by Russian politicians, who make no secret of the fact that they still see Ukraine as part of Russia's sphere of influence.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton. This is FSN Reports. Conspiracy of Beards is an a cappella male voice choir with a unique musical repertoire. The San Francisco-based ensemble interprets and performs exclusively the songs of the world-famous Canadian poet and singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen. Our reporter Rebecca Bowring joined the choir for a live performance and discovered more about their unusual origins.
I was born with the gift of a golden voice and 27 angels from the grave beyond.
The Beards, as they're known, have travelled to Point Reyes Station in Marin County, north of San Francisco, to bring their Leonard Cohen covers to the airwaves. They're making an appearance on community radio. DJ Brian Kirvan isn't used to welcoming 15 studio guests at the same time.
I have to say this is a unique experience to have the Conspiracy of Beards in the booth today.
So long, Mary Ann.
The group performed So Long, Mary Ann from Cohen's 1968 debut album, Songs of Leonard Cohen.
And cry and laugh about it all again.
And Who by Fire, written more than a decade later and derived from a Hebrew prayer. Leonard Cohen's been covered by artists from Jeff Buckley to Nina Simone. Choir member Yosh Warren says the power of his music lies in the often dark lyrics about love, death, sex and spirituality.
There's a real tension between opening yourself upward to holiness and how that's sort of intricately intertwined with the baseness of human existence and feeling.
Musical director Daryl Henline agrees.
I truly believe we've got the best words and we've got a lot of them. And so that's our mission, is to be stewards of that text and to be, you know, vessels for the intention of Mr. Cohen.
Conspiracy of Beards was founded more than a decade ago in memory of the visual artist Peter Kadich. Before he passed away in 2001, he dreamed of an a cappella male choir singing Leonard Cohen songs. A one-off performance grew into regular rehearsals and events. There are currently about 30 singers, all amateurs, and more than 100 have come and gone. Founding member Tim Weitz arranged many Cohen pieces, drawing on diverse musical influences.
I have taken liberties with what he's done. I've used the chord structure or something, but tried to put it in a doo-wop form, or tried to, you know, aimed at doing a gospel arrangement.
If I've got to remember, that's a fine memory.
The result is rich, haunting, multi-part harmonies delivered in stylish suits and fedoras. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show. Email us. We're there, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can get us on Twitter, @featurestory. Coming up on Wednesday, the Zimbabwean business owners being forced to hand over control of their livelihoods. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Here's the man himself, Leonard Cohen, to play us out.
They will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.